How does a young person deal with the threat to his future of environmental catastrophe?
I decided to imagine him as a 19-year-old, as a college student, as a botany major. And that got me into trying to think about how a college student today who's interested in plants, and he's specifically interested in disappearing plant species, in plants at risk, how somebody like that would understand the ecological disaster that we face.
How does a young person deal with the threat to his future of environmental catastrophe?
There are people that believe we shouldn't live here. You shouldn't live on this piece of land. It should be sand. God bless them.
The United States is surrounded on three sides by water. The West Coast, the whole Gulf, the whole East Coast. Everyone just can't get up and move in 1 mile or 2 miles.
That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. In a few days, as this show is being produced, thousands will gather in Washington, D.C. and in cities around the country and the world for the People's Climate March. All ages will gather, no doubt, but those who are young know that they will probably spend most of their lives dealing with the many catastrophes that climate change will bring them. Extreme weather, food and water shortages, health impacts from heat and the spread of insect-borne diseases, and the fraying web of life, shredded by mass extinctions of animals and plants. My guest Ellen Meeropol's new novel, Kinship of Clover, explores what mass extinction looks like from the point of view of one of its main characters. Jeremy is a botany student at college, whose bouts of anxiety about the disappearance of the species he studies is manifested in his body as a kind of somatic metaphor. He feels extinct plants growing into and out of his skin, leading him and others to question his sanity. But is there any sane reaction to the threat of extinction we face from climate change? What's crazier, to be obsessed about it or to ignore it? Many, like the marchers on April 29th, find solace in political action. But what kind of activism is best? And how to balance the needs of those near and dear to us with the urge to risk all to take action. These are some of the questions Ellen Meeropol asks in Kinship of Clover. She spins her multi-generational tale with a compassionate and sensitive pen as we follow her characters through their confrontations with mortality, both personal and global. Ellen Meeropol is the author of two previous novels, House Arrest and On Hurricane Island. Some of the characters in House Arrest reappear years later in the novel we talk about today, Kinship of Clover. Well, Ellen Meeropol, welcome back to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here.
So this book, Kinship of Clover, is your third novel dealing with political issues. You're the author of House Arrest and On Hurricane Island, and we've spoken to you about the latter one. This novel, this new novel, is about the impact of our unfolding eco-catastrophe on a young person in particular, which I found very interesting because you and I are both of an older generation. We grew up in the 1960s. We have more in common with some of the other characters in the book. But I've often thought about, and I often do think about, what is the impact of having your whole life ahead of you and facing this kind of catastrophe. So tell us first about Jeremy, one of your protagonists in this novel.
Well, Jeremy was actually one of the minor characters in House Arrest, my first novel. he and his twin brother lived in this oddball cult that was subjected to a lot of harassment by law enforcement and had some pretty bad things happen to them as a group. When he was in that book, he was 9 years old. He was a sensitive kid who liked to draw plants and who liked to hang out in the family greenhouse. And maybe 4 or 5 years after House Arrest was published, which was in 2011, he started pestering me. And he started saying, "Don't you want to know how I turned out?" And I did. So I decided to imagine him as a 19-year-old, as a college student, as a botany major, which would have been a logical way for him to grow. And that got me into trying to think about how a college student today who's interested in plants, and he's specifically interested in disappearing plant species, in plants at risk, how somebody like that would understand the ecological disaster that we face. So getting into his head and trying to understand what all of this would mean for him was the way I approached this novel.
So the novel opens. He is in a place that I know very well, actually. He's a student at UMass, and he's in the campus radio station, which is where this show, Writer's Voice, actually started back in 2004.
Yes, I remember well.
And he's got a show called Plants in Peril. And something
yes.
happens to him right in the middle of broadcast. What happens?
The plants come alive in a way that is unusual. He's talking about plants that have become extinct, that have been destroyed by civilization, essentially. And the plants start growing out of the furniture and out of his body. And the plants sort of become one with him. This has happened to him once before when he was 9 years old. And you get a little bit of a flashback of that 9-year-old experience. That time it was pretty benign. This time at the radio station, it's very disturbing to Jeremy. The plants are growing into his body. They look like plants that he has studied that are no longer on this earth. He knows they can't be real, but they look real and they feel real. And he reacts in ways on the air that cause the station manager to come and shut him down and escort him to health services for evaluation.
And so, now, is this in the original novel as well, in House
no.
Arrest?
Mm-hmm. No, it wasn't in the original novel as well. And it wasn't even in the first, I'd say, the first 25% of the first draft of this novel. But one day, I was sitting at the Forbes Library in Northampton, in the writer's room, where people gather a couple of times a week to work on their own work in the company of other writers. And I was writing a scene, and the plants started doing this. And my reaction was, oh, my God, what's happening here? I didn't plan this. I didn't foresee this. I didn't choose this, but it happened. And one of the things I love about writing fiction is that sometimes things like this occur. And your imagination, when you're just writing in a fluid and free kind of way, your imagination takes over and things happen that surprise you as much as they might surprise any reader. So this happened, and I loved it. And I ended up kind of rewriting the beginning of the book to make this part of the story.
And so how did you process it? Is it just a metaphor? Is it a bit of magical realism? How do you see it?
You know, depending on my mood, I see it as either metaphor, magical realism, or hallucination based on a kid with a really traumatic childhood whose mind is kind of playing tricks on him. So you can see it as pathology, or you can see it as magical realism, or you can see it as pure lyrical playfulness. And I had no idea writing the book until really I got to the end. And even then, I don't want to tell the reader how to see it, because I think it can be interpreted in different ways.
Right. And as you say, he had a traumatic experience when he was young, and his family broke up. He has a twin brother. Tell us about his twin. Very, very different, almost a polar opposite.
Yes. The two boys have had very different responses to their family, both to the strangeness of the commune or cult that they grew up in, and to the world in general. So Jeremy is a botany major who's very, very concerned about plant extinction and environmental issues in general. Tim is a business major who wants nothing to do with any of what he sees as the foolishness of their family. And of course, this is true in real life, that it's hard to predict how children will think about and grow up vis-a-vis their parents and their parents' passions. So it was fun developing these two very different characters and developing the things that they share, because in some ways the brothers are quite close because of what they went through. And they also shared some childhood passions. They were both very involved with the X-Men movies and the characters, and these characters were really almost siblings or friends to them in the years when their father was first in prison and they were, and their life was really pretty difficult. So their friendship has persisted, but they also both act as foils for each other.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Ellen Meeropol about her new novel, Kinship of Clover. So Jeremy has a kind of breakdown at the radio station, and he ends up going to visit his twin in Brooklyn, New York. His twin lives in Brooklyn like every other young person, it seems, in the United States.
Exactly.
And his brother, I wondered if it was almost out of character, but his brother introduces him to some folks that he thinks he can relate to. And these are people who are very engaged in the climate movement, but on the extreme end of the climate movement. I guess you could call some of them eco-terrorists. First of all, talk a little bit about that, and then why did you choose to explore this fringe part of the environmental movement?
Well, I think that the reason that I decided to do that is that I like a clash of ideas in fiction. Most of the people who Jeremy meets in Brooklyn are pretty ordinary climate activists, like I know in my area and would be around anywhere. There are a couple of people in that group who make some decisions that are pretty much on the fringe and are certainly not the usual climate activists choices. But as I said, I really like there to be a clash of ideas Because I think that that opens up the conversation to the reader. So the reader has a way of saying, what would I do in that situation? What do I think about the different kinds of actions they're talking about in this meeting? What do I think is the right way to try to make change about the climate disaster that we face? And Jeremy has to make those decisions. Jeremy has to look at the different things that are suggested in these meetings and figure out how he fits into this continuum of available ways of responding.
Yeah, and in your last book, On Hurricane Island, you had a character who was anything but a terrorist, but was treated as one. So I thought that that was kind of an interesting contrast.
Well, I like looking at the range of responses to our political challenges. To me, it's just very interesting, the things that people come up with. You know, we have major challenges to deal with in this country, major political and environmental issues to address, and there's not agreement, and there's not just one road, one pathway to try to make the necessary change. And I like the cacophony of different ideas.
And you have, I don't know if it's Jeremy or another character poses this question, but I think a very important question that's relative to this is, how do you stay true to the people you care about while trying to change the world? And, you know, I think that's something that's facing a lot of us today. I mean, even if it comes down to just, how do we take care of ourselves and our family at a time when we feel pushed to be as active as we can to try to preserve democracy?
Absolutely. Jeremy certainly knows from his own childhood and the choices that his family made that there are often huge costs to being different and specifically to political activism. And one of the other major characters in this novel is Flo, who is an older woman. She's in her mid-70s. She's been an activist her whole life. And she and Jeremy, even though there are over 50 years of age difference, are both in some ways struggling with the same issue. How do you make change and how do you stay true to the people you care about when you're making that change? And Flo has also experienced personally the costs of being an activist and the costs of some of the choices that she has made in her life. So writing the conversations between the two of them was so interesting to me and so much fun, some of it.
And if you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with novelist Ellen Meeropol about her just-released third novel. It's called Kinship of Clover. Yeah, and I'd like to talk a little bit more about Flo, because she's also dealing with another great challenge, and that is Alzheimer's. And I have been, well, my mother didn't have Alzheimer's, but she had cognitive decline, and I recognized a lot of what was going on there, you know, times of tremendous lucidity, as you point out. Flo can have a great conversation, a very perceptive one with Jeremy, but she can also, you know, put herself at risk by her problems with memory. It seemed like you might have been going through something similar to what Flo's family is going through and trying to deal with her. Is that true, or have you experienced
yes.
that?
Yes, yes, it is true. My mother had Alzheimer's. She died about 7 years ago. And in the last, I was very involved in her life during the period of her decline. And I spent a lot of time with her, and I took a lot of notes. I sometimes wrote down whole conversations because I was so struck by how one moment she could be making no sense at all, and the next moment she could be so eloquent and express something that was so perceptive. And I was often floored by the contrast between the different ways that her brain was working. For a long time, I had no idea what I would do with those notebooks, and I didn't really have plans to write a character based on her. And actually, Flo is not based on my mom, but the Alzheimer's parts of Flo's experience are very similar to those of my mother. So when I developed Flo, actually Flo was also a minor character in House Arrest, although she had just a bit part. And when I decided to bring her into this new book, and I started writing her, all of these memories of my mother came back and sort of fleshed out Flo's experience on the page.
I think it's very effective. And there was also one part, before we go back to some of the other characters and plot lines, you take the opportunity in writing this character, Flo, to talk a little bit about how people are treated when they are old, when they are beginning to decline. And I found that powerful. And Flo has to deal with the whole issue of being given medication, off-label medication. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that, and why did you include that almost as a warning in this book?
Well, you know, Alzheimer's frequently has periods of behavior that are socially unacceptable. Some people become quite belligerent, and are verbally or even physically assaultive. And it's not uncommon for medications to be used to try to address those behaviors. Unfortunately, there aren't really good, or there haven't in the past been really good medications to address that. The ones that were available, certainly when my mother was in this situation, have some pretty significant potential side effects. And rather than create environments in which an individual with dementia can be safe and still have some personal agency, most healthcare seems to be trying to simply sedate the behavior so it's not too difficult for staff to manage. I know there are other parts in the world where there have been some different approaches to that, and some innovative approaches in this country as well. But in general, you know, we don't do well in our healthcare system in general when it comes to managing things that we can't cure. And I think that's particularly true when most of the people involved are elderly and we know that we can't cure this disease.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, my mother was given an antipsychotic medication that's very extreme. And mm-hmm. when I saw that, I said to the doctor, I said, she's not psychotic. Why are mm-hmm. you giving this to her?
Yeah.
You know, and I think it really had a detrimental effect. But back to your book, Kinship of Clover, there's another major character here. She's really lovely. There's Zoe and her father, Sam, as well. Zoe is disabled. Talk a little bit about her and what role she plays in the book.
Well, Zoe was also a character in House Arrest. She was a 5-year-old, very feisty kid. She has spina bifida. And in Kinship of Clover, she's 16. She has chosen to use a wheelchair for mobility, and she's actually one of my favorite characters. She's loosely based on a number of children and adolescents with spina bifida I knew in my previous life. I was a nurse practitioner, and I worked a lot with this population of children and families. And she's somebody who is really determined to live her life as fully as she can, to take very little nonsense from people who feel that they should be able to protect her or boss her around or any one of a number of other things that she's not interested in having done. And in this book, she has sort of her first beginnings of romance, which was, again, enormously satisfying to write.
So have you written other characters that are disabled as well, or differently abled?
I have, although not as much as of a main character as Zoe is.
Yeah, and I remember the last time we talked, I'm not sure if it was on air or off air, but I think it was off air, we had a little talk about cultural appropriation, about writing characters that are not like you.
Yes.
And I wondered if that came into play a little bit in writing about Zoe.
You know, I think about that all the time when I write any character who is part of what might be considered a vulnerable group. And it's clearly always a concern, and it's always an issue. I really believe that writers not only have the right, but the responsibility to try to write outside of ourselves. It's one of the pleasures of writing, to try to put yourself into somebody else's shoes and skin and see the world through somebody else's eyes. It's a great responsibility, and I think that I, like many writers, do my best to do the research and to get it right, and I acknowledge that it's probably pretty easy to get pieces of it wrong. But if I only wrote 70-year-old white women, my books would be really boring. And I, as I said, I think it's our job to try to open up the world. I think it's the job of all writers to try to see beyond ourselves and to understand the world as broadly as we can, and to really explore what it might feel like to be other people.
Well, Ellen Meeropol, your latest novel, your third novel, is Kinship of Clover, and I want to thank you so much for talking with us here about it.
Thank you, Francesca. It's a pleasure.
Ellen Meeropol. Kinship of Clover is published by Red Hen Press. Next up, sea level rise brings bad tidings to Seabright, New Jersey. Stay tuned after the break.
How high is the water, Mama? 2 feet high and rising. How high is the water, Papa? She said it's 2 feet high and rising. But we can make it to the road in a homemade boat, 'cause that's the only thing we got left that'll float. It's already over all the wheat and oats. 2 feet high and rising. How high is the water, Mama? 3 feet high and rising. How high's the water, Papa? She said it's 3 feet high and rising. Well, the hives are gone, I lost my bees. Chickens are sleeping in the willow trees. Cows in water up past her knees. 3 feet high and rising. How high's the water, Mama? 4 feet high and rising. How high's the water, Papa? She said it's 4 feet high.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Living on Long Island, the vulnerability of our coastline to sea level rise is obvious to me every time a big storm blows through and tears out another portion of our beaches. But at least for the next decades, and possibly another century, if we're lucky, Long Island's coastal residents have some inland space to retreat to. Not so the community of Seabright, New Jersey. Just a slender spit of land, the residents face the grim reality of climate change now and in the near future. It's likely that their homes will be underwater sometime in the next 50 years. Dan Natale's documentary film Bad Tidings asks some tough questions. Should the residents of Seabright stay, or should they go? Will adaptation work, or is it foolish to challenge Mother Nature? Through Natale's interviews with scientists, politicians, the Army Corps of Engineers, and residents, he illuminates the tough choices that face all of us as we confront the increasing impacts of climate change. Dan Natale majored in environmental policy at Rutgers, where he also earned a certificate in digital filmmaking. Well, Dan Natale, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thanks for having me.
So this film, Bad Tidings, it's really a very thought-provoking film, and I think the first one that I've seen other films about sea level rise. In fact, I'm glad to say that there are a number of them, and I've even interviewed somebody recently about one that he did. But this one really packs a punch in terms of asking, how are we going to deal with a problem in a community that is not likely even to be around by the year 2100 if sea level rise is going in the direction that it seems to be going?
So you're saying it was one of the few that you've seen that focus on individual community more?
Yeah, and just not kind of the reaction to Hurricane Sandy and the recovery from it, let's say, or the recovery from storms, but really what we face and the choices that people have to make.
Yeah, especially being from New Jersey, there were a lot of Sandy documentaries that came out that were really, I kind of felt like a little bit, not unfair, but they really weren't thoughtful or representative, or they didn't take into account what we should really be thinking about in the wake of a giant storm like that. They really all focused on, okay, look how inspirational it is that we were able to build these communities back. Now, if you look at it just that way, you're taking out a ton of factors that really go into a problem like that. For example, I'm sure we could rebuild, but that says we have the money to rebuild. That says that, you know, we're spending the money to rebuild when we should be maybe spending it on different things. And it doesn't, you know, take into account, you know, the causes and, you know, the fact that these storms could happen at any time and will happen again, almost certainly. And, you know, it brought up a bunch of the questions about climate change that people have been thinking about, you know, since Al Gore's first documentary, pretty seriously. What's going to happen in 50 to 100 years if sea level rise is as drastic as the scientists are predicting? And, you know, that's where I came in. I just decided just to focus on that. And I didn't really have any allegiance to either scientists or community people or people living in Seabright. I just wanted to, you know, tell it as honestly as I could.
Yeah, you did a great job with that. Now, the community that this film is about is Seabright, New Jersey. Describe it as a physical place and then as a community.
When you say physical, what do you mean by that? Like,
what's it,
just the way it looks?
And... Yeah, what's it look like? Because when you look at the aerial photographs, one is struck by its vulnerability.
If you look at it through the context of sea level rise, and if you look at it like really wide view, like I did in my documentary, you're like, whoa, this is a tiny strip of land. And, you know, even the slightest change in sea level, it's obviously going to be gone, you know. You know, so yeah, as a physical place, it's this tiny, tiny strip of land on the side of New Jersey. And that's actually why it was the perfect place to film this. Because if you look at a normal shoreline, I guess it's harder to imagine because you'll just be like, oh, the shoreline will recede. But when it's on both sides, you're like, well, you can't just do that because it'll involve the whole strip of land. And you might be thinking like, oh, it's just a small community, but, you know, any community being lost to climate change is a huge, you know, tragedy, you know, regardless of whether they're rich or poor or whatever. So, yeah, as a physical place, tiny beach on the side of the Jersey Shore, it's really pretty. That's one of the main things about it. It's a great place to be. It's, you know, a really good tourist destination and stuff like that. So, yeah, it's Seabright for you.
Yeah, and as you say, even just a little bit of sea level rise, you know, one of the scientists says just a few inches of sea level rise, it makes a huge difference and really means that Hurricane Sandy already packed the punch that it did, which it might not have prior to the sea level rise we've already seen.
Yeah, that was another thing. I'm not a climate scientist. I'm just a filmmaker, and I just saw all these things line up in front of me to tell a story, but that's one of the main things I got from all the experts talking about it, was that sea level rise, even if that isn't going to submerge the community completely, added sea level adds to storm surges. And yeah, they one of the scientists says pretty confidently that Hurricane Sandy was caused by climate change and sea level rise. He doesn't believe that the storm surge would have been nearly as intense had this been a few decades earlier or something, when, you know, we didn't damage, you know, the climate as much as we have to this point. So yeah, it's kind of like a double whammy that, you know, Seabright has to worry about. One of the biggest things everyone says is, oh, there's natural disasters everywhere. You know, there's tornadoes in the Midwest, stuff like that. But they don't really consider that, yeah, these things are going to get worse, you know, because of climate change.
And this film is very much about how this community is grappling with the issue. I was struck by someone who says very early in the film, she says, I'm an environmentalist. I care about things like, you know, pollution and stuff like that, and I'm sure she does. But she really pushes back really hard on the idea that the community may need to retreat from the sea.
Yeah, I mean, in her defense, I mean, I guess, you know, she spent a ton of money and so much, so many resources building her house back. You know, she, like, that's why I really tried to do it as balanced as possible, because after going to all these people's homes and looking at them, you know, there is a side to it where they had this trauma. They had to rebuild their homes. They have their whole lives invested into it. And I get where she's coming from in that, like, you know, she has so much of her heart planted into her home, as anyone would. But when she says that, there's an element of denial there. I mean, I think maybe somewhere in her mind she knows that she is vulnerable. Nothing could really stop what nature is going to do to her home. But there's also a side where maybe she believes that she will be safe. That we can't really know. We can't really know why she said all that stuff. But I think she's kind of where a lot of people are, who, you know, they know it's going to happen, but what are we going to do? And, you know, you wonder, like, could you really tell someone to leave their home based on a scientific issue like that? Right now, there's nothing physically stopping anyone from living there. It's really just the idea that if they don't do something, their homes are going to be gone.
If they don't do something, say more about that.
So a lot of the options that they were given in terms of what to do were either rebuild, bulkhead, put seawalls in front of their homes, pump more sand onto the beach, replenish the beach, just so it stays there. But a lot of, like, environmentalists, not people just claiming to be environmentalists, like, you know, some residents in it, a lot of, you know, environmentalists will say that these solutions don't work. They say that they're stopgap solutions, that they'll maybe last a few years at most. And a lot of it's right. Seawalls, you know, are proven to add to the storm surge. Even in Seabright, the seawalls there, they increased the amount of water that came into the store, the businesses in town, and knocked out every single business, as they talk about in the film. So they might have even done more harm than good by even having those.
Yeah, explain that. How did that happen? The seawall actually increased the impact of Sandy on the downtown.
Yeah. How exactly it worked, I don't know the physics of it so much, but from the interviews I got, they said that it worked as a funnel, more or less, for the storm surge that was coming in, because all the water that wanted to go directly over the seawalls, the energy was then directed into this one gap in the seawall, and that worked as like a funnel, and it had this huge like kind of swirl effect where it just kind of really, really hit those businesses and just knocked them all out. You could say it protected some of the homes, but even a slight flaw in its design could add to huge amounts of devastation like that.
Yes, I live in East Hampton, New York, which while it's not as, I mean, it's very vulnerable, not quite as vulnerable as Seabright because it's a bit larger, but certainly our coastline is every bit as much as vulnerable to that. And we've had a lot of experience with bulkheads, and what they do is they are temporarily protecting the homes that have built them in front of them, but then they erode the beaches that are on either side of the homes. And there's plenty of evidence. I mean, at high tide, you can no longer walk all the way along the shoreline.
Oh, wow. Yeah, it's the same thing in Seabright. They add to the erosion is one of the biggest problems of that. And that adds to another problem with the way they build the beaches, in that since it adds to erosion, they have to pump sand onto the beaches, which is absurdly expensive. And I think a lot of that comes from taxpayer money, which is, you know, one of the biggest controversies of the whole thing. Sure, we could rebuild everything. We have the money, we have the technology to do it, but it's at, you know, for the most part, the federal level. There are, you know, obviously a lot of local money goes into it. It's not just that. But a lot of people are like, why are we paying taxes for someone in Seabright, you know, to rebuild their shorelines or any shoreline? And, you know, I guess I'm maybe going on a tangent here, but, you know, you could wonder about federal money for anything nowadays, especially with our new president wanting to build, you know, a wall on the Mexican border. Like, I don't want to pay for that, but, you know, that's beyond the point. I just had to throw that in there.
I don't think that's beyond the point. I mean, what you're really talking are the choices that are being made.
Yeah.
You know, one of the folks in your movie, Dan Natale, in Bad Tidings, says 46% of the GDP of the country is located along this coast, mm-hmm. and that this is a coast that I think the latest estimates I've seen is that we could see a 6 to 9 foot sea level rise by 2100.
Yeah.
You know, when you've got that level, basically that's lower Manhattan, that's Atlantic City, and that's huge swaths of the coastline that's drowned.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and, you know, again, you know, since we're talking about, you know, federal money on what to protect, obviously it's better to replenish the beach than build a wall on the Mexican border. Because the truth is, if as a society we decide we're still going to live along the coast, given, you know, climate change projections, then we got to build it up. We have to protect, you know, these communities. Obviously, we're not going to get rid of Lower Manhattan. So, you know, that's just something that I think, you know, we should spend money on. But I guess really the point of the documentary was, like you said, to make people think really critically about it. Like, knowing that this is going to happen, what's the right course of action for society in general? Knowing that certain areas are super vulnerable to, you know, climate change and sea level rise.
It's also maybe the issue of politics really comes in. I'd like to... you asked a question of a scientist at one point. I'm going to just play that here so you can hear that and his response, and then tell us who he is and what you thought of the response. You ask him, would you live there?
Oh, yeah.
That's a good question. How do you want me to answer? Want me to answer that truthfully?
I guess you guys.
Yeah. So who is he?
Who is that?
Who was this? And you know, just talk a little bit about what happened there with that question and how he responded and who he was.
Yeah. Well, first of all, who he is, I actually think is really important, and I wish I could have gotten into it more in the film, but it wouldn't have worked with the story I was telling. But this guy is basically, you know, a rock star scientist around here. He has this huge glider program where he sends these gliders around the United States. His name's Scott Glenn, by the way. Sorry, I forgot to mention that. But yeah, so Scott Glenn, big scientist. Originally, though, he wanted to be an astronaut. That was his first goal. But I think he had a minor heart problem that didn't allow him to blast off. And that sent him on a whole new life mission, basically, to explore the ocean, which is I thought was pretty crazy. But considering the level of intensity he lives in, the things he's gone through, you know, trying to be an astronaut, traveling the seas on these glider missions, he is not someone who lives, you know, a safe life, you know. And to hear him say something that seems as innocuous as, oh, would you live along the shore? And for him to be scared to do that, I think is really telling. So, yeah, that's really why I asked him, because when I first started talking to him, I asked, you know, should we be rebuilding the shoreline the way we are? And he basically said, look, I'm a scientist. I don't have the authority to answer that question. And then I asked him simply, would you live there? And he said, no, I don't think that's a good idea. Because he knows his home could be destroyed in, you know, the blink of an eye.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Dan Natale about his film, Bad Tidings. Right. I think there was a recent poll that came out that showed that some 80% of Americans know that climate change is happening, know that it's human caused, yet they don't think it's going to affect them. Your film shows that, no, it not only will affect us, but is affecting us and already has affected us. Why do you think the politics are so toxic still?
Well, I guess it's because, first of all, you know, it's generally not visible, like too visible in a way that really grips a lot of people. And its impacts, for the most part, aren't something that people feel could be completely blamed on climate change. So that's one side of it. Like, for example, a bad storm, you could say any number of reasons caused that. So that's one piece of it that allows people to say, oh, it's not really a big deal, not going to affect us too much. Okay. The other side is, you know, obviously the giant conspiracy everyone talks about, where oil companies don't want climate change science to be accepted, you know, by the public because they want to keep, you know, selling us oil. They don't want people to cut down on CO2 emissions because they don't want to find a new source of energy. That's one side of it. And then since that's been, you know, kind of placed in a lot of people's minds that this is a debate, when it really shouldn't even be a debate, it allows certain politicians to still ride on that. You know, for example, again, with Donald Trump, he still went on the whole climate change isn't a big deal, we shouldn't be focusing on this, sometimes denying it. You know, I don't know what he actually believes. It's just whatever he'll say to get votes. And, you know, it allows for people to use that as a platform, whether or not they believe it, I think. And, you know, it's really only in the U.S. that it's a culture war, you know. And I think that's super bizarre because, first of all, most people aren't scientists to begin with. Most people, I don't even think, would ever think about the weather that deeply to have such a strong opinion on it. But they've kind of been energized by a lot of these polarizing politics to, you know, decide whether or not they're climate change deniers or believers. And yeah, I think those are a few sides to it. And I think it's maybe just been a narrative that's been kind of accepted for one reason or another. And Yeah, I think it's stupid, but what could he do?
Did you experience pushback in making this film?
What do you mean by pushback? You mean from climate change deniers?
No, just hostility. When you you went into the community, were there people who were hostile to what you were doing? And
I was actually really worried about that when I first started. And when I went into the community and, you know, talked to him about it, I just said, look, we're doing it on this topic. Say what you want about it, you know. We're going to present it in as even a way as possible. And I was surprised. They were pretty open and honest about what they thought about it, you know. I expected them to either not talk to me or give me responses and then say, oh, don't use this or that. But, it was easier than I expected. And even after I made the film, you know, I showed it to them and I was expecting some pushback then. But, you know, yeah, at the end of the day, it wasn't as challenging as I thought it would be to get the kind of candid responses I got from a lot of the residents, which, you know, I think is a testament to them. They, you know, they mean what they say, whether it's right or wrong.
Right. And even, you know, it sounded like, for example, the mayor, Dina Long, you know, she seemed to have a pretty clear-eyed view.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was also surprising. I guess we're so used to politicians having this coded speech or not saying exactly what they think or believe. You know, you see it all the time. I know even Chris Christie a lot of times, you know, is going to say things that aren't necessarily probably even reflective of what he thinks. They're just to get votes. But I was really surprised by what a candid, honest discussion I had with Dina Long about the topic. And I think it's because she's living in it every day. You know, if you're a governor, you're not necessarily living in each community and you don't know what it needs. But she knows that they need to do something about this issue. And I think she, at the end of the day, she just wants what's right for her residents. So if that's to get the word out that there's this climate change sea level rise problem, then, you know, that's what she's going to do. And I think that's what she did.
And otherwise, as she says, Pennsylvania, here we come. Expect New Jersey.
Yeah.
Now you're young. You're 24, is that right?
Yeah.
You're 24 years old. You're going to be living with this your whole life.
Mm-hmm.
And I know you majored in environmental policy at Rutgers as well as in film. How do you confront the, you know, really the existential threat of climate change? You're taking a proactive view, and that's wonderful. But I wonder if you could talk a little bit about maybe some of the complex emotions you have in not only doing this film, but in confronting this whole problem.
Yeah. Well, you know, honestly, after doing this film, I have kind of a more open mind, as weird as it sounds. And I actually have more questions than I have answers. You would think it would make it easier. But the thing I realized is that if you don't really critically think about something, it's really easy to come to a simple solution about it. You know, if I didn't do this film, I would probably have a much simpler idea of climate change, and I'd probably give you a whole spiel about, oh yeah, you know, save the trees, don't drive cars or something. But the way I look at it now is kind of, well, you know, there's not a simple solution to it. And I guess because I'm doing it on my own, I didn't have to necessarily have an agenda with it. I know a lot of organizations will do films with a goal of, you know, let's get this message out, but I kind of just wanted to paint a picture of it more. I guess, like, the internal debate I have with it is, I guess, with humanity in general, because humans, since they've been able to think and have been able to make tools and kind of change the landscape for their own, they've always totally messed up the natural order, even before climate change was a problem. In some ways, I think it's just what's going to happen, and we have to find solutions to it, which is a little bit depressing, but also a little bit, at the same time, I guess, not inspiring, but I don't know what the exact word is, but I think that it's going to happen, but I think people are ingenuitive enough to think of and find solutions to it. And what exactly is going to happen, I don't know the specifics, but I think I'm on the side that we'll be able to adapt, as weird as it sounds.
In spite of the fact that in your film itself, there are a number of scientists who, you know, who say, these folks think they're going to adapt, but they got another dose coming.
Yeah. When I say adapt, though, I also mean that some tough choices are going to have to be made. I think some communities are going to have to leave. I think it's already happening in Alaska. In certain places, people are having to leave their homes. It's also happening in a few small island nations where they're already sinking. Like, the places are already being put underwater, and there's climate refugees. So that's something that's going to have to happen. And the depressing part of it, the part that gets me really upset, is that I don't think there's anything we could do to stop it at this point. I know that sounds really like a downer, but to stop CO2 emissions would be to completely re-engineer society. We have roads made for cars driving everywhere. To not drive in America in this day and age is near impossible if you want to have, you know, a productive life. So that's, you know, my perspective is that it's going to happen, and we need to think of solutions. And I think they're going to be, the thing is, there's not going to be a one-size-fits-all solution. They're going to be specific to certain areas. I focused on one area, and I think the solutions there are leave or continue to pour money into it. And I think what I think honestly is going to happen is they're going to keep pouring money into it until it's not sustainable anymore. And we're just going to have to wait and see to when that's going to happen. And if it takes another storm, there's nothing you can do to stop it. And it's either going to make people want to leave, or they're going to do it again. And only time will tell.
Well, that's so true. Yeah. Well, Dan Natale, your film is Bad Tidings. It's really a wonderful film. As you say, balanced. It tells its story through the stories of the people without you imposing your own opinion on it. Thanks so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
Dan Natale. Go to badtidings.com to see the film or find the link at writersvoice.net.
I don't know what I would do if they came and said you can't rebuild your home because, you know, soon we'll be underwater. I think it's crazy. I think to myself, what would I do if my town was going underwater?
But yeah, a lot of people just want to walk out their door and be right on the beach. Well, you know, that's a luxury. It's not a right. And unfortunately, you keep building in places where nature says you shouldn't build, and then you pay the consequence.
So we had a real bad storm here, obviously. Sandy, Seabright Village, and the rest of Seabright should prevail. Now it's move on to what we have to do next.
The cleanup stage.
That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.